From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
Deadly terrorism struck in New York for the first time since 9/11. The attacker will be tried in federal court, but the president is already tweeting he should get the death penalty. The president also wants to end the diversity visa lottery that brought the attacker to the U.S. from Uzbekistan in the first place. We'll discuss. Plus, it's Mueller time. Two of President Trump's campaign associates have been indicted, and another is pleading guilty to lying to the FBI. Where might the Russia investigation go next? Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. On this week's show, MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell joins us to discuss his new book, Playing with Fire, an account of the 1968 election. What can the election that elevated George Wallace and brought us President Nixon teach us about today? And Megan McArdle and Gene Sperling will join me to break down the new Republican tax bill. What does it mean for the economy and for you? It's all coming up on Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Lawrence O'Donnell, host of The Last Word on MSNBC and author of the new book Playing with Fire, The 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. And our special guest is Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, professor at the University of Texas, fellow at the Center for Politics and Governance at the LBJ School of Public Affairs, and contributor to MSNBC and NBC News. Welcome, everybody. On Tuesday, New York City suffered its first fatal terror attack since 9/11. The truck attacker, Saifullo Saipov, is originally from Uzbekistan. He immigrated to the U.S. through the diversity visa lottery, which gives green cards to immigrants from countries that don't produce a lot of immigrants to the U.S. President Trump tweeted that Mr. Saipov should get the death penalty. He flirted with the idea of sending him to Guantanamo Bay, but then decided not to. Trump also demanded an end to the diversity visa lottery, which he warned can admit dangerous people to the U.S. So, Rich, after Las Vegas, the White House thought it was too soon to politicize a tragedy. Is it too soon to talk about immigration policy?
Well, the too soon argument is a process argument, and both sides end up being hypocritical on process. I'd like to see everyone in all these instances maybe have a 24-hour waiting period before we have the intense policy debate. But that said, it's very difficult to stop anything like this because you have basically a lone wolf who appears to have been self-radicalized using a means of murder that is extremely low tech, and there's no way to ban it or limit it, namely driving a truck. I do happen to agree with the president on the diversity lottery, not necessarily as a way to stop these lone wolf terrorists from coming here, because I don't think it makes any sense on its own terms. I think immigration policy should have a couple goals. One, getting immigrants here that have the skills to help us in a 21st century economy. Two, reuniting families from immigrants who are already here and providing some relief from refugees from war-torn countries. This serves none of those goals. It's a completely random program, and it is bringing in people who are completely unattached to this country, which is a potential problem in terms of assimilation.
Vicky, can you give us a little bit of background on how this program came to exist? It started in the 1980s, I gather?
Sure, it did. And it's funny because when President Trump said that Chuck Schumer was the father of the diversity visa and he pegged him, he was absolutely incorrect. You need to go back to Ted Kennedy in the 1980s when he was negotiating the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act. So in order to appease a very strong Irish-American lobby during the 1980s who was feeling frustrated that the last big immigration reform of 65 didn't allow for sizable numbers of Irish immigrants to come to the United States, made a big push in the 80s and were able to get this special provision of an extra 10,000 visas for the next 2 years from 86 to 88. And once that was set, once that horse trading had been met, it kept rolling along, and then it got bunched into the 1990 Immigration Nationality Act, which is what we know of today as the diversity lottery system that Chuck Schumer is now most closely associated with.
So, Lawrence, what we've been hearing from Democrats in response to this, I mean, first of all, is, you know, it's gross to turn this into a political attack on Chuck Schumer. But then Schumer and others point out that comprehensive immigration reform would have gotten rid of this program. Chuck Schumer was a sponsor of a bill that would have implemented a new immigration system, would have ended the diversity visa lottery. So I guess the question is, it feels like we ought to be able to have a sensible conversation about immigration that would involve ending this program. It just doesn't feel like the president's setting that up.
true, but let's not delude ourselves that there's a regime of immigration law that would prevent something like this happening, that would prevent a person like this from some other country, some other place, coming into the United States, developing or already harboring these kinds of feelings that turned homicidal in Manhattan. If you look at a set of comparable events, you can see a completely different country reacting to this sort of thing in 1968 when Bobby Kennedy is assassinated in what is the very first act of Middle East conflict-inspired terrorism in the United States. He is shot and killed in Los Angeles by Sirhan Sirhan, who was an immigrant. He was a Palestinian immigrant, came to this country when he was 12 years old, certainly at that point harboring no homicidal intent. He shot Senator Kennedy because Senator Kennedy had sided with Israel in ways that he did not like. And so what was the country's reaction? What was the president's reaction? Did Lyndon Johnson immediately declare, we must do something about immigration, we must especially do something about immigration from Palestine? Did the president say, this person absolutely should get the death penalty? Of course, none of that happened. None of that happened. And I raise it just by contrast to where we are now in the age of Trump. And when you get to the death penalty in Sirhan's case, when the judge was actually considering the death penalty, the big message that he got was a handwritten letter from Senator Ted Kennedy, who had now lost two brothers to assassination. And that was a letter to the judge pleading for the life of Sirhan Sirhan, saying, please, if you were to follow the feelings that my brother Robert would have had about this, he would have not wanted another life to be taken in this story. That's where the president was on something like this in 1968. That's where the victim's family was on something like this in 1968. And look where Trump puts us today.
Well, so let's talk about the president's overt call for the death penalty here, which, you know, this came out on Twitter twice, and it led to this bipartisan freakout, where basically, like, the president's not supposed to do this. The defense is going to be able to say in the case that the president is prejudicing the jury. And Rich, this just feels to me like one of these things that, like, everyone in the elites, people understand why this is a procedural problem, but you're never going to get anyone to care.
Yeah, most people, this is a sentiment most people, I hazard to guess, agree with. Now, it's barstool opinionating of the sort you don't expect or want from a president of the United States, and any attorney or prosecutor would tell you it's not helpful and you don't want to do it, but I can guarantee you this guy will still be found guilty.
Vicky, I mean, what should the president be doing right now?
Well, so it's a new normal when we're talking about President Trump. You know, the thought of our executive tweeting out that the death penalty should be implemented is just, it's incredulous until now. So I'm at the point where nothing is going to surprise me about President Trump. But taking a step back, I do have to give it to President Trump in terms of him really having his finger on the pulse of the barstool, which Rich just referred to, where folks gather around. It's such a great tragedy. People are feeling so frustrated, so scared. And so something like the death penalty is something very simple, very concrete, that most folks who are outside of the Beltway can hold on to. So President Trump knows that, and he's stoking that, even though he should be in a different place. But he is very much speaking to his base, and I would say to also the raw emotion that the country is feeling right now.
But is that, I mean, do you have to give him credit for that? It's not that hard to figure out that people are angry at a terrorist and would like to see him receive the death penalty. I don't think that's some sort of political genius.
He did it, and he won the election. So many of us thought, oh, no, President Trump, or candidate Trump, he's crossing the line. People are going to turn his back. The skill was that he was able to walk the line and do it and get elected. You know, where he goes from here is a different question, but he was able to thread that needle.
Let me just give the president credit for exactly what he did do with his death penalty tweet. Let's give him the full credit for this. He is the only president in history who has interfered with a federal prosecution this way. He is the only one. He has poisoned the jury pool. Richard Nixon apologized when he, in an impromptu press conference, stumbled into talking about Charles Manson before he was found guilty, as guilty. He actually used the word, you know, Manson's guilty of. He immediately issued a written statement retracting that, saying, of course, there is the presumption of innocence until found guilty. He pulled that back instantly. And as a lawyer, Richard Nixon was terribly embarrassed at having crossed that line that had been established very clearly by the United States Supreme Court in the 1960s about the issue of prejudicial pretrial publicity. And when prejudicial pretrial publicity is overwhelming, there is only one solution that is available, and that is a change of venue. So if you've had overwhelming prejudicial pretrial publicity in, say, Los Angeles, we can move this to Northern California and try the case there. This is the President of the United States who has created prejudicial pretrial publicity in every conceivable jury pool within the jurisdiction of the United States. There is no legal remedy for this now, because there is no change of venue possible. And if this was a lesser crime, there would end up being no prosecution because of it. What will happen is, I think Rich is right in the notion that the president is predicting the future here. The courts will find their way around the doctrine that they have established about prejudicial pretrial publicity in order to allow for a prosecution here. But they will be violating the principles to do it, but they will do the practical things they have to get there. And you'll get a jurisprudential result, but you will probably add years to the prosecution because of what this president did in a tweet that every prosecutor involved is horrified by, because he has quadrupled their workload.
The funny thing here, though, is that Ross Douthat was tweeting the other day that by 2019, the president is going to be tweeting that he is suspending the Constitution and establishing martial law and making himself a dictator, and that everyone's just going to ignore it and act as though the president hadn't said anything at all. So, you know, this is a trial that presumably will end up happening in Manhattan, where Donald Trump got 10% of the vote. People didn't like him here to begin with. People don't take seriously most of the things that he says. It almost seems to me like that actually makes this statement less prejudicial. If people don't take the president seriously, then it matters less if the president is saying things that he's not supposed to say. Rich?
Well, I also think it's pretty prejudicial that we have information that this guy wholly confessed in his hospital bed, and we have video of him running around in an intersection in Lower Manhattan after crashing his truck after he's mowed people down and ran into a school bus, which is also highly prejudicial. So this is Trump shouldn't have said this, he shouldn't have tweeted this. But to Ross's point, so far, Trump is a threat to our political norms, to our political culture, but none of the things that actually would constitute a serious threat to our constitutional order, he's shown any desire to follow through with, or even if he did, there's any indication that anyone would go along with it. A great example of this is the threat to pull NBC's broadcasting license. Sorry, Lawrence. You know, too bad you don't get your license anymore. But he's not going to do that. And if he did, no one would actually follow through on it. So there's just a freak out every week that I think should be more modulated to, well, a president shouldn't be saying this, rather than hair on fire case that he's violating our Constitution. He's not.
I've been talking with Rich Lowry of National Review, Lawrence O'Donnell, author of the new book Playing with Fire, and Vicky DeFrancesco Soto, professor at the University of Texas. I'll be back with Gene Sperling and Megan McArdle to talk taxes. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Lawrence O'Donnell, author of the new book Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. And our special guest is Vicky DeFrancesco Soto, professor at the University of Texas and contributor to MSNBC and NBC News. So this week it was Mueller time. Special Counsel Robert Mueller indicted two figures in the Russia investigation this Monday, former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort and his business partner, also a former Trump campaign official, Richard Gates. They were indicted for financial crimes related to their work on behalf of a pro-Russian political party in Ukraine. More surprisingly, Mueller unsealed a guilty plea that was entered earlier in October by George Papadopoulos. Papadopoulos, who graduated from college in 2009, was one of those no-names who inexplicably showed up on the list of five foreign policy advisors that Trump announced in March of 2016. George Papadopoulos, he's an energy and oil consultant. Excellent guy, is what Trump said at the time. Papadopoulos apparently tried repeatedly to broker a meeting between then-candidate Trump and Vladimir Putin. The meeting never happened, but then in January, the FBI interviewed Papadopoulos about what he was up to with the Russians, and he lied. So now he has pleaded guilty to one count of lying to the FBI, and the filing around his guilty plea seems to suggest that he's a cooperating witness in the Russia probe. So the Trump team defense here so far when they talk about Papadopoulos is basically, this guy is an idiot. Who is he? Some low-level volunteer. Trump just read his name because we needed to say we had a foreign policy team. Nobody took him seriously. So the thing about the Trump campaign is it was so shambolic that this claim is actually slightly plausible, right?
It's entirely plausible, and they hired this guy in the first place because all the respectable foreign policy advisors had signed letters saying they'd never work for Donald Trump, and that's why you get Trump, you know, reading this guy's name and trying to puff him up when he was justly mocked at the time for having the Model UN on his resume. So my big takeaway on this, it's another indication that there are these feelers from Russian officials or people around Russia about having information on Hillary Clinton, and that's concerning. But we know it's fairly low level, and we don't know what came of it yet. And my belief is that collusion will ultimately probably be a dry hole. And what the big game here could be is if their vulnerabilities of the president himself or his family in terms of business dealings with Russia that were somehow compromising. And the way I read this week's events, it was politically shrewd of Mueller. You know, those of us are kind of Russia skeptics. When the indictment first came out of Paul Manafort, we were already right. Well, this has nothing to do with Russia. It has nothing to do with Trump himself. And then, boom, he releases the plea deal, which had been, you know, cut several weeks earlier. There's no reason really to release it Monday, except for it made the case. Oh, no, wait a minute. There is some Russia stuff here. So if I were Mueller, I'd get some indictments under my belt. I'd get these cases going. And then if I think there's, you know, the trail leads to the business dealings, that's when I begin to subpoena, hit Trump's tax returns and other business records, and dare him to fire me when it would be the most thermonuclear act in American government in decades.
Lawrence, what do you think these indictments and this plea tell us?
Well, the most important word in all of Robert Mueller's filings this week is the word guilty. His very first case, the first case that we know of sequentially in all of this, is already a guilty. And a principle to always have in mind as we watch this investigation unfold is an incompetent, unprofessional campaign is much more likely to make mistakes, do things illegal, than a professional and experienced set of campaign operatives. Let's grant the White House position for the moment that George Papadopoulos is an idiot and a low-level volunteer, staffer, or whatever we want to call him. Your job in running a campaign is to make sure idiots remain outside of headquarters, that they remain out on the street and they do not get into your volunteer system, and that they don't contribute anything, and that they don't sit with the senator from Alabama who's on his way next year to become the attorney general. They don't sit with the candidate who's on his way to become the president in photographs and in important looking meetings and in meetings that you are maybe even staging to look important. That's not where your incompetent idiots are supposed to be in a campaign. And so the likelihood that this campaign tripped over the legal wires that surround campaigns is actually a much higher likelihood because, in their own view of things, they brought in idiots.
Vicky, what did you think?
So the ABC Washington Post poll came out this week, and it had 49% think that President Trump committed a crime. And so that leaves us with 51% not necessarily believing that he committed a crime. And then there's varying degrees of that sentiment. And what's interesting to me is that this further highlights the polarization, that half of our country thinks that we have a criminal in the White House, and the other half thinks that it's essentially a witch hunt and that Trump was brought in to shake things up and that he needs to be left alone and let him do his job. So I think this, to me, indicates that polarization. And it also highlights the status quo that is going to be here for a while. So we see the slog that's going on with the Mueller indictments. There's a little bit of movement forward. We'll see where this leads, but there's still no smoking gun, and we're at the beginning of the slog. So for me, it seems like we're going to be in this status quo, this 49-51% of people who are diametrically opposed for quite a while now.
Rich, where does this leave Jeff Sessions? Because I feel like you and a lot of the other conservative observers of this campaign who've had some skepticism of Trump have basically had a position that they didn't believe Jeff Sessions would be involved in anything remotely like this. And we keep having these issues where Jeff Sessions claims not to have met with any of a certain kind of people mm-hmm. or not to have known about anything. And then they go back and it's like, oh, I forgot about this, but I took a lot of meetings. So now the claim here is that they were in this meeting and Papadopoulos basically says, I can broker a meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. And that it's Jeff Sessions there who very forcefully says, no, of course not. We're not going to do that. Don't even talk about it because it might leak if we do that. So but that would even if Jeff Sessions was the person saying the right things about how these meetings shouldn't have been taken, shouldn't he have been in a position to know that there was all sorts of inappropriate feelers being made around Russia in the campaign that needed attention, that this was a problem, even if he wasn't part of creating the problem?
I'm not sure, because what we know about that meeting is Papadopoulos says, well, I'm trying to broker a meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, which isn't collusion. It's monumentally stupid, and which is why Jeff Sessions shut it down. But we don't know that he said at that meeting or to Sessions at any other time, oh, well, this mystery professor or shadowy professor is telling me that there are these damning emails. So it may have never gone up to Sessions. But he's going to have to go back and explain himself yet again, and I think his defense is that he may have been thinking of all these Russian questions in terms of collusion, you know, some sort of dirty deal between the Russians and the Trump campaign, and he is not aware of that and doesn't think it happened, so has set aside these other things which seem more damning in retrospect and more damning than I would argue than they really are on the merits, just given the obsession with Russia at the moment.
That thing about the emails is remarkable. I mean, Lawrence, Papadopoulos does seem like someone who inflated his credentials in a number of ways. So if he was saying that he had high-level contacts with the Russians, one might not believe him. But he was saying in April of last year, months before we got any of the WikiLeaks releases, that the Russians had all of these damaging emails on Hillary Clinton. So someone who was in a position to know something about that was talking to George Papadopoulos.
And very far up the ladder in the Trump campaign, Sam Clovis, who the Trump and Trump campaign respect so much, they wanted to make him Undersecretary of Agriculture until these emails came out. Sam Clovis is telling Papadopoulos great work, and he's doing it in writing, in emails. And so there you see the low-level idiot staffer that the Trump world now wants to dismiss being told he's doing great work by one of the guys up at the top of the campaign. And so this is all, we're on page one of the Papadopoulos story and what it has to tell us. Already on page one, it has cost the Trump administration their undersecretary for agriculture undersecretary Sam Clovis, who as soon as this was revealed, it was the easiest prediction I've ever been given the chance to make on Tuesday to say his nomination will be withdrawn. I couldn't pick the exact day, but it turns out
the agricultural department will never be the same.
I saw Rich though like grimacing when he heard the name Sam Clovis.
Well, I mean, it goes to Lawrence's point about idiots. I mean, if the charge here is idiocy, yeah, they're going to be guilty up and down the chain. I mean, Don Jr. was an idiot, and one reason he was an idiot because he'd never been in a campaign before, and the Trump campaign was lousy with such people.
I want to turn and talk about Lawrence's new book. So first of all, the book Playing with Fire is going to be released on Tuesday, November 7th, so congratulations on that, Lawrence.
Thank you.
So the book is about the election of 1968, when Richard Nixon succeeded Lyndon Johnson. What is it about the 1968 election that Americans need to know right now?
Well, there are elements that were born in that election that we saw playing out in our last election. The George Wallace's campaign manager told me last year and in the book that whenever he would listen to candidate Trump, he was hearing candidate Wallace. They were so similar in all of their respects, and I'll just give you one that you'll recognize as fairly unique. George Wallace was the very first politician to get up on a stage and revel in protesters. He would use the protesters in the audience to show how tough he was and fight right back at them. And he would be disappointed if he didn't get, at that time, you know, long-haired hippie protesters in his audience who he could yell back at and call commies. And you cut to Donald Trump in 2016 standing up there saying, "I want to punch them in the face." And it is just, and calling his protesters animals, which is exactly the same word he now uses for terrorists. And between George Wallace and Donald Trump, there is no one. There's not one presidential candidate between those two who thought, the protester is the thing I want in my audience so I can show them how tough I am. And there are many elements on the Democratic side, models that were created in 68 that we saw this last time around, and that is especially the insurgency from the left against the establishment. This was an invention of Eugene McCarthy's in 1968. It had never happened before. Bernie Sanders was the Eugene McCarthy insurgency of 2016. And as usual, in both cases, the Democratic Party establishment was the last to realize that something interesting and important was happening in their party, as is true of party establishments generally. The Republican Party establishment was the last to realize that Trumpism was real. And this story of 68 is where I believe all of the dynamics of our modern politics that we have lived with really for virtually all of our lives now, the culture wars, the so-called, all of that was born in 68, and you're simply seeing more and more refined elements of it as we proceed.
One thing you say in the book is that voting in 1968 was a matter of life and death. You had the enormous stakes of the Vietnam War and the draft. You had the enormous stakes of the fights over civil rights. And I think people sort of feel like there's a similar cultural moment now in certain ways to the 60s with the intensity of culture war and the intense divisiveness in politics. But it feels like in certain ways the stakes are actually a lot lower now than they were then. I mean, you had thousands of terror incidents and bombings in the early 1970s, shortly following this election. Are we in a position that's similar to the 1960s, or was the level of political unrest actually a lot higher then than it is now?
I believe that in our psyches, in our souls, we have a very similar sensation to 1968, but objectively, everything was much worse in 1968, much worse. And the threat was much more personal and intense. I think virtually everyone wakes up every day thinking about government. That's what they're thinking about when they're thinking about Donald Trump and when they're thinking about what is Donald Trump going to do today. Whether you're a Trump fan or a Trump opponent, you have an ongoing concern about how the Trump day is going to go today, and looming around it all day long is this wallpaper, which is new, of a possible nuclear conflict with North Vietnam and a tremendous lack of trust among the population about the person who would be running our nuclear conflict with North Vietnam. In 1968, every 18-year-old male was carrying a draft card in his pocket, which, if he had not yet publicly burned it, was his ticket possibly to death in Vietnam. That is a very intense and personal threat. You were threatened, your brother was threatened, your nephew was threatened, your boyfriend was threatened, your son, your grandson. Everyone was aware of this risk. Everyone was partaking in this risk. And there was a tremendous amount of risk avoidance being discussed at all times, people trying to get out of this. Most, as in all war situations, most men didn't come close to combat, and most men didn't want to. And so we had it created our very first serious anti-war movement, which was coming literally out of the energy of 18-year-old males and above trying to save their own lives.
Vicky, one of the things that Lawrence is describing here is sort of an increased democratization within both political parties. You had Lyndon Johnson brought down in this campaign due to objections to him within his own political party. Around the same time, you started to see an opening up of the Republican nomination process that brought us Ronald Reagan and has sort of brought us the very bitter intra-party fights that we see on both sides right now. Has that been a good trend for the U.S., that increased voter control over the political parties?
Well, the 1968 election, like the 1860 election, is what we describe in our classic Poli-Sci 101 class as a realignment. So I think change can be a good thing. It wasn't in the sense of 1860, and I think in a sense in 1968. But I'm going to turn the question back to Lawrence and ask him whether he foresees a large-scale partisan realignment such as we saw in 68 and then 100 years before that. Are we going to see the Republican Party as we know it today transform, shape itself into something different? Because it just can't sustain the Trump portion of the party right now.
Well, I don't have the answer to that question, and that's what we are all pondering every day. Is this a one-off, and is this just one character who can pull this off? I think what we do know is that Republican policy, if we can call it that, on immigration is going to follow the Trump talking points, at minimum the talking points, if not all the details. If Trump were to resign from office tomorrow, he has established a position on immigration, which was the initial ignition. It was the initial policy ignition of his campaign. It was really the only thing he was talking about for a while. That I think is their policy. But you couldn't define either one of the parties through their immigration policy. That would not be anywhere near the top five things that would define the Democratic Party or the Republican Party before Trump. That's the one thing I think we're sure of as a change. And it's not the other thing that would be big for Republicans and is at least temporarily a big change is their position on international trade. And I doubt that Trump has established a new long-term Republican Party policy on international trade, which is to say anti-trade. But we will see. And we will. This is one of those things that we're going to have to wait for history to tell us.
If I could just underline a couple points that Lawrence has made, and congratulations, Lawrence, on the book. I don't know how you managed to write such a substantial book when you have a nightly TV show. But George Wallace and Donald Trump, the similarities are so striking. I mean, it's basically a Wallace message and Wallace affect minus the segregationism and the hostility to federal power. And on Vietnam, there was a documentary that ran on PBS several years ago before the Ken Burns one, and I was just so struck by just how impossible it would be today to basically grab young men, more or less off the street, train them up briefly, and send them into a jungle halfway around the world. It would just never happen today. I also agree with Lawrence that I think, even though our divisions feel so fraught and deep, we're experiencing nothing like we did in the 60s and the 70s when we had assassinations, high-profile assassinations, when we had civic strife and cities literally burning to the ground, when we had domestic terrorism. And just one last point, we tend to think of the norm of American politics, or the definition of that goes back to the era from the end of World War II to 1968. But you think about it, the abnormal in American politics from 1968 to 2017 has been a much longer stretch, and maybe we should think about that being the American norm rather than the exception, which was those 2 decades after World War II.
It's remarkable to me how little we've talked about Nixon here, because I feel like a lot of people make comparisons between Donald Trump and Richard Nixon, the ideological flexibility, the dishonesty, the being beset by corruption scandals, resentment of elites, having a savvier grip on what middle America wants than Eastern elites give them credit for. Lawrence, do you see those Nixon echoes in Trump?
There are so many. And Nixon, we have to remember, was very much afraid of losing voters to George Wallace. And that's part of how the Southern strategy got developed for Richard Nixon and for all future Republicans. But let me just go to one point, which is the point of the day, and that is collusion. If the Trump campaign is found to have been in collusion with Russia, it will be the second Republican presidential campaign that won with that element. Richard Nixon was indeed fully colluding with the South Vietnamese government and passing messages to the North Vietnamese government to get them to not agree to any progress in peace negotiations, because the one thing Richard Nixon firmly believed he needed to win was the Vietnam War to be continuing and to continue to look hopeless, because he was the candidate who was going to change all that, according to his campaign. And so he had secret communications, which President Johnson and the CIA eventually found out about. They found out about it very late in the campaign, that Nixon was communicating directly to the South Vietnamese, telling them, don't do what you just promised President Johnson you would do and go to Paris and negotiate. Don't do it. Pull back from that, and I will get you a better deal when I'm president. And this is now documented down to the point of Bob Haldeman's personal handwritten notes during the campaign of Nixon telling him what to say to their secret emissary, to the South Vietnamese. And the case is as solid as you could possibly ask for. And so if Donald Trump somehow benefited from collusion in his election campaign, that makes him the second to have done so.
I've been talking with Rich Lowry of National Review, Lawrence O'Donnell, author of the new book Playing with Fire, and Vicky DeFrancesco Soto, professor at the University of Texas. I'll be back with Gene Sperling and Megan McArdle to talk taxes. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. Republicans have been talking about their plans for tax reform for weeks, but this week we finally got legislation. The new Republican plan to cut taxes would add $1.5 trillion to the deficit over a decade. A trillion of those tax cuts would go to businesses. About $200 billion is for repealing the estate tax, and there are $300 billion in individual income tax cuts. The last version of the Republican plan came under some criticism because it would have raised taxes on many middle and upper middle income families. But now they've tweaked it a little bit, hoping to address that. To break down what this tax plan would mean for America, we're joined now by two experts in all things economic. Coming from the left is Gene Sperling, who directed the National Economic Council under Presidents Clinton and Obama. And from the right is Megan McArdle of Bloomberg View. So, Megan, the central conceit of this plan is basically that what America needs is not just a tax cut, but specifically a tax cut on businesses. That if businesses pay less tax, they'll create more jobs and grow the economy, and that ultimately ordinary workers would be better off. Is that right? And is this plan going to be effective in making that mechanism work?
Well, it is sort of right. It is certainly true that, you know, the economic models would say that if you cut business taxes, you are increasing the incentive to invest in businesses, that all else equal, you are going to have more people employed then working at those businesses. That said, as a lot of economists like to say, ceteris is rarely paribus. And of course, you have to finance these tax cuts somehow. How is that going to happen? They've raised, you know, it looks like this is about laser targeted to really hurt high income professionals in blue states, and that they're bearing a really weirdly disproportionate share of the burden here. But you also have to see, what are they going to come up with to offset this, if anything? What does this do to the deficit? And if it increases the deficit, you know, you're also drawing money out of the economy just at the same time that you're putting it back in. So it really depends on details that we don't entirely have at this point.
Gene, what do you see as the likely effects of this plan?
Well, I think the issue is just what you said, Josh, which is the overriding premise that I think they're going to have a very hard time selling to the public, because I think it's counterintuitive and counter to past experience, is that the number one problem in their lives really is that major multinational companies have not gotten a big enough tax break. And yet, Josh, if you look over the last 16 years, you have seen that corporate profits as a percentage of our economy have nearly doubled. And yet at the same time, the percentage that goes to employee compensation is at near record lows. So there just hasn't been shown to be this connection between higher corporate profits and them putting the money into American jobs. And so their answer is to say, we're going to give major companies $1 trillion with no conditions that they invest in R&D, investment in jobs. And this time, somehow, it's going to be different. And I just think it's going to be a very, very tough sell. And I encourage progressives to embrace their proposition, and let's have a debate on that. I think most people would think that if you had that much resources, it would be better going directly to working families, to the earned income tax credit, to infrastructure, skills, college opportunity, that those type of things would make a much bigger difference in the lives of middle class families.
So, Gene, when you look at even tax reform plans that have come from Democrats over the last decade or so, they've often involved some sort of cut in the corporate income tax rate. When we set this corporate income tax rate a little bit over 20 years ago, it was pretty typical for the world. A lot of other countries have been substantially cutting corporate income taxes over that period under basically the same theory that underlies this Republican plan, that if you do that, it will create business investment and jobs. Have those countries been making a mistake? Has the U.S. had the right policy all along and other countries have erred by cutting these taxes?
So, Josh, I think the difference is this is the case where there's a difference between giving a huge net tax cut and reform. So obviously, when I was National Economic Council Director for President Obama, we did propose lowering the corporate rate to 28%. But no, we didn't give a single penny of a net tax cut. We were just trying to rationalize the system. We also had real strong protections against shifting to tax havens, where I think their so-called minimum tax will actually encourage more outsourcing and sending profits to tax havens. So I think if this was tax reform, Josh, where they were lowering the corporate rate without increasing the deficit by a penny, if they were taking the one-time funding from a one-time repatriation tax and using it for infrastructure, I think you could have some discussion. But this right now is a very, very large giveaway at the time when, if you look closely at their plan, it doesn't even succeed in giving middle class families much of a tax cut. And indeed, as I'm happy to discuss, will actually lead to a tax increase for millions.
Megan, when people talk about this idea of, you know, tax cuts to encourage investment, usually you want to try to design the plan so that it specifically rewards new investment. But one of my main criticisms of this, and one that I think we've seen a lot from even people on the right, is that a lot of it is basically just a giveaway to people who've already made investments, who are already wealthy, a big tax cut for Trump family businesses in here, things that don't necessarily encourage new business investment, just reward people for investments that they made in the past that obviously we can't change through the tax code.
In theory, that's correct. But in practice, you have this problem, which is that just rewarding new investment, you always end up making the tax code more complex. And in fact, what they're trying to do here is simplify the tax code. I think they're also trying to give a tax cut to corporations, let's be honest. And I think one of the least defensible things in this plan is the special tax rate for pass-through businesses. I don't see any reason that pass-through businesses should get a special rate of 25% that is not available to other people. It is actually regressive for people who own small businesses that don't generate that much income, where their taxes on their income will actually go up.
This is a key point that I don't think has gotten clear, in part because the president in particular has been misleading people about this. There's this small business tax cut in the plan. They say, if you own a small business, your income from that business will be capped at no more than 25%. But the thing is, 85% of people who report business income on their taxes already make little enough money that they're already taxed at 25% or less. So you basically, the president gave this speech where he was like, you know, truckers will benefit from this. Well, you'd have to be a trucker who made at least like $130,000 a year to benefit. So really, this is just a provision for relatively wealthy and extremely wealthy people. It would also apply to Trump companies that are organized in this form.
Indeed. It looks like a generous personal gesture from the president to himself, to paraphrase John Kenneth Galbraith. But, you know, in theory, you want to incentivize just new investment. But you always run into this thing with the tax code where, in theory, I just want to incentivize this one thing. So I'm going to add one little provision. And then I'm going to add another little provision. And the next thing you know, we have exactly the problem that I've been critical of this, but I give Republicans credit for this much. They are taking on some very popular deductions like home mortgage interest, not as aggressively as I would like, but they've actually touched it. And, you know, they're taking on some business deductions, and that is all to the good. We should have a simpler tax code. We should not be thinking about the tax code in terms of like every little thing we want to incentivize. And because of that, I think that is why actually a low overall corporate tax rate is a good idea. Because again, then you're not trying to use it to make it the economy do one thing or another. You're just saying we're going to get rid of the deadweight loss that all taxes have, corporation taxes especially, because they are so easy to avoid or to structure around, I should say. So there are things to like about this plan, but I think part of the problem is that it does look so skewed towards corporations. And even if you think that that is actually economically the right thing to do, politically, that is going to be a huge, huge problem when they go to sell this to the public.
Gene, when people look at this plan and the concern about middle income and upper middle income tax increases in the plan, very often that's happening with people who currently use things like the mortgage deduction, the deduction for state and local taxes paid. And I guess my question is that people do say they want a simpler tax code. And the way you make the tax code simpler on the individual side is have people deduct less and just pay lower rates. But then if you get rid of deductions, then some people who rely a lot on those deductions are likely to come out behind. So I guess my question is there a way to do individual income tax simplification that doesn't have this problem of raising taxes on a lot of families that make, say, about $80,000 or $130,000?
Well, I think when you're doing tax reform, it's a little bit like deficit reduction. You have to have a bit of moral authority and fairness. If you're asking, for example, as you say, a lot of upper middle income people are going to get a tax increase on this because they're going to lose their medical exemption, they're going to lose their state and local deduction. If you can say that this is being done to truly lower everybody's tax cuts or it's raising money for infrastructure jobs, you have a bit of moral authority to ask for a compromise. But this goes to our previous conversation. If what you're doing is you're saying, I want you, middle income family, to sacrifice, perhaps pay higher taxes, but at the same time, I'm going to give a $500 billion tax cut to pass-throughs who are largely in the top 1%, make over $260,000. If I'm going to give nearly $200 billion to people who have estates over $11 million, if I'm going to give nearly $1 trillion to major companies, not doing tax reform that's deficit neutral, but actually net trillion dollars, then I think that moral authority is lost, and I think people have a right to say, why am I sacrificing? Why am I paying higher taxes so that we can give the largest companies and the most well-off Americans a higher tax cut?
One of the criticisms we've been hearing about this plan from some Republican senators, Marco Rubio and Mike Lee in particular, is that it doesn't do enough for families. They want a much bigger increase in the child tax credit because of the loss of certain deductions related to dependents. So some families could actually end up losing tax benefits under this plan the more children they have. Megan, is that approach that Rubio and Lee are proposing right? Should there be a much larger tax credit for being a parent?
Well, this goes back to, I prefer a simpler tax code. If I had my druthers, we would get rid of the corporate tax entirely and tax all income when it hits a person at ordinary income rates. But I do not. And if we are going to be structuring the tax code, given that the United States has something of a demographic problem, not nearly as big as it is in Europe, and given that children are expensive and getting more so, if you were going to have credits in the tax code, children are about the most defensible thing that you can have credits for. And what Rubio and Lee are looking at is, they are part of a movement to rebrand what I think is ultimately a healthy attempt to shift the Republican Party off of its obsession with marginal tax cuts. This is the one thing they can all agree on. It is the one policy that comes up every time they're in office. And, you know, it made sense under Reagan, but we are now at a point where most people's taxes have been cut. Most people do not pay as much as they did in the 1970s. And therefore, first of all, this is politically a dumb issue. But second of all, we're heading into an entitlement crisis. We have to find a way to pay for all of the promises that we've been making for decades, which means that tax cuts are like the worst possible thing to be fixated on, except maybe growing entitlements at exactly the point where we can't pay for the ones we already have.
Gene Sperling and Megan McArdle, thank you so much for joining us. We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Vicky DeFrancesco Soto, what's on your mind?
The opioid epidemic. Lots of talk on how we can tackle it, namely the report that just came out this week, which I think is great. We need to tackle it, but talk is cheap. As Jerry Maguire would say, show me the money. Where is the money to attack this? And beyond that, so in talking about repealing the ACA and cutting back Medicaid, the first thing that is going to go is drug rehabilitation. So if Trump really wants to do something about the opioid epidemic, put your money where your mouth is.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Major League Baseball just concluded a gripping World Series that featured two of the most wildly entertaining World Series games in a generation. It's a sign of baseball's continued vitality, but there's a problem. The games are too damn long. Fortunately, as I've mentioned on this very program before, there's some easy fixes to make it better. A pitch clock, a ban on all visits to the mound by anyone, and a prohibition on batter timeouts. At its best, baseball is a tense, enjoyable game, but the tension and enjoyment needn't be interminable.
Megan McArdle, what's bugging you?
Halloween has touched off the perennial debate in American life, which is, of course, milk versus dark chocolate. On the one hand, you have the chocolate snob, the dark chocolate snobs telling people that they are childish for liking milk chocolate. And on the other hand, you have the milk chocolate people saying that the snobs don't actually like the chocolate they're eating. They're just doing it to irk them. I think it is time for a detente in these wars. De gustibus non est disputandum. And let us recognize that some people do not like the bitterness of dark chocolate and some people do not like the sweet creaminess of the milk side, and that we can all live together in harmony as one country if we're just willing to let each other have room to believe different things.
Megan, the really trolly opinion to have is that white chocolate is the best kind of chocolate.
Okay. No, those people should be exiled.
Gene Sperling, what do you want to rant about?
Well, as a milk chocolate fan, I'm going to rant about that President Trump has already shown a complete disregard for the Justice Department and rule and law in both his courting and his firing of James Comey and Preet Bharara. But as a column by John Liebman discusses, Trump is now interviewing for just the three U.S. attorney positions that most affect his family holdings and possible money laundering investigations: Manhattan, Brooklyn, and D.C. But my rant isn't another rant at Trump. My rant is at the silence of Republicans for standing mute at this clear abuse of the rule of law bordering on obstruction of justice that they never would have tolerated for even a single second if it was a Democratic president doing any of this.
Lawrence O'Donnell, what's your rant?
I'm sitting at the end of what is now decades of surprise that Anita Hill's testimony in the Senate confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas did not teach America, particularly American men, what they had to know about behavior in the workplace. And this isn't even a matter of whether you believe Anita Hill or not. What you got at that time, what the country got at that time, was a very clear set of warnings of what is absolutely unacceptable and what is against the law. And the lesson fell on so many deaf ears that it remains stunning to me that we could be having these stories at this point after what I thought was the moment where America was supposed to have learned the lesson.
That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Vicky DeFrancesco Soto, Lawrence O'Donnell, Gene Sperling, and Megan McArdle. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is Phil Richards. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.